Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm host of New Books in Literary Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm delighted to speak today with my guests, Catherine Grenier and Amanda Buchel, about the volume that they edited and recently published, Cultures of Memory in the 19th Century, Consuming Commemoration, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2020. Catherine Grenier is the author of Tourism and Identity in Scotland. She's historian of modern Britain with specialization in 19th century Scotland. Her book, Tourism and Identity in Scotland, Creating Caledonia, won honorable mention for the Frank Watson Book Prize for the best book in Scottish history, published in 2005-2006. Her current research examines Sabbatarianism in 19th century Scotland. Amanda Buchel specializes in 19th century history and the history of the Old South. She's a contributor to the Southern Middle Class in the Long 19th Century, which was published by Louisiana State University Press in 2011. Amanda has worked on several projects for the Virginia Center for Digital History, including The Valley of the Shadow and Digitization of the Annual Bibliography of Slavery and World Slaving, originally published as a supplement to the Journal of Slavery and Abolition. She has served on the content team for the International African American Museum and as editorial contributor for the Lowcountry Digital History Initiative's online exhibits on African passages, Lowcountry adaptations, and the James Pierce Daybook, the account of a Charlestown merchant, 1760-1765. Hello, Kathy and Amanda, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
The volume focuses on the 19th century. How does this century stand out in terms of commemoration practices and in terms of how memorial practices were understood?
Amanda, you want to start? You know, we were interested in this period because it seemed to be a period when we really begin to see some of the commemorative practices that we see today. In particular, the kind of commercialization of memory and of consumerism, and the fact that as you see the rise of a growing middle class, objects of consumerism and these sometimes replicas of items, these become accessible to a larger number of people. More people are able to travel, they're able to participate in some of the secular pilgrimages of commemoration that we see here. And so it becomes a time when you have the growth of this commemorative culture, and one that's very much also tied to the development of a culture of sentimentality in the 19th century that's particularly tied with the rise of the middle class. So all of these things kind of come together in this period.
Mm-hmm. Added to that, I think that we see in the 19th century a time of a lot of new nations, new emphasis on national identity, of nationalism, as well as imperialism, all of which involve teaching lessons of patriotism, teaching lessons of loyalty, And memory becomes a big part of how those lessons are taught through monuments, through processions, through tourism, through commercial practices, but also through very overt political practices. Public memory becomes a big part of ideas of nationalism and national identity. So that makes the 19th century powerful in that sense too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm intrigued by this statement that you just made, that the 19th century, of course, is marked by the development of nationalism, which was somehow combined with imperialism as well. But you said that new nations appeared, and I'm wondering how new nations were represented, or how new nations found their ways, right, in that imperialistic narratives, which were based on different commemorative practices.
You know, the new nations, of course, don't just appear. Mm-hmm. They're formulated, they're fought over, they carve their way out. You know, I think that happens in a couple of ways. You can talk about American history in the 19th century as forming a nation, especially, as I understand, in the period after the Civil War. You can certainly look at nationalism in Europe in this period. But you can also look at empire and how ultimately, maybe late in the century, the early 20th century, those people who have been occupied start really overtly carving out their own national identity in contrast to those who have ruled against them or ruled them.
Mm-hmm. Amanda, would you like to add anything to this?
Well, in sort of defining who is the nation in the 19th century, and that's certainly something that two of our essays in particular look at in the aftermath of the Civil War, the American Civil War, is the place of African Americans, of newly freed African Americans in a reunified United States in the aftermath of the Civil War, and the appropriation of, or the assertion of, control over public space as a way of inserting themselves into the public sphere and political life in a very overt way, and then using that kind of commemoration to protest those who keep them out. We've got another essay that looks at a former prisoner of war prison that had been relocated from Richmond, Virginia, up to Chicago in the aftermath of the Civil War. And that becomes a space for, it's a very complicated space, but one of the things that's going on there is a question of reunification, mm-hmm. and an effort to sort of bury the divisions and reassert a unified American identity that often runs counter to the experience of the actual prisoners who have been held there. And so it's kind of a contested space in that sense, but it's very much about sort of reconstructing in that way, but recreating a unified United States.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thank you. You mentioned contested space, and it's also one of my interests, contestations and contested space. So in your opinion, how does one deal with contestations, and whether those contestations were somehow dealt with in the 19th century, or maybe the 19th century was some time period when the contestations were created?
Do you mean how do we as historians deal with this, or how do people have time?
Like, mm-hmm. as a historian.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that we wanted to show through the book, which a lot of historians have talked about, is the way that individual choice becomes a factor, the actions of individuals, the agency of individuals, how we remember a space, how we remember the past, is expressed through the choices that individuals make. And we want to make sure there's that sense of sort of the agency of individuals, mm-hmm. in helping to decide what a space means. You know, the essay by Ashley Towle on Randolph Cemetery in Columbia, South Carolina, in the Reconstruction era, is maybe a good example of that. You know, local African Americans chose, we want to remember that this man was killed and how he was killed, putting money into buying the cemetery, choosing to participate in the processions, is making a statement about how they want their history to be remembered. They can't control the whole situation because the context changes, and as Reconstruction, or the white reaction to Reconstruction turns more violent, their ability to control the situation is limited, but they can continue to express their voices. And I think that's a big part of how the space gets contested.
Mm-hmm. And to take it in particular with that example, to use public streets to as part of a procession, to use the event of mourning as a time that's sort of a sacred time where African Americans can take that space, where white Colombians will allow them to use that space in that way. So it's a very sort of strategic use, mm-hmm. An assertion of belonging in the public streets of the state capital of South Carolina, and of course being the state that started the American Civil War, and that, as with many other southern states, had recently been involved in, as Kathy says, often violent efforts to turn back the Reconstruction of the South. What was also interesting in some of these essays was the question of monuments, and so we see that in certainly in Danielle Nielsen's look at the space of the Durbars in British India, and the way that British tourists were encouraged to see the sites that had been associated with the 1857 uprising as sites that were exclusively having to do with a British imperial presence in India, rather than ones that had a long Indian past to them. And so constructing things like the Cawnpore Memorial Well and guidebooks that encouraged people to take particular tourist routes and to understand them in a particular way as they did so is really this assertion of control over that space. And then kind of as a counterpoint to that is the final essay in the book, which looks at the way that contemporary Indians are looking at the legacy of colonialism in Indian identity today, and often sort of turning it on its head or questioning that through artwork, through photography, through sculpture, and playing with these ideas from the colonial past.
Mm-hmm. I know that this question will be beyond your book, but can we draw parallels between the 19th century and the 21st century in terms of the monuments? Last summer, there was a lot of controversy around monuments in the States, and I would say it's also true for other countries as well.
Absolutely. And this was a project whose genesis really came out of that. Mm-hmm. The conference that it came out of was in the process of being planned at the time of the 2015 massacre of churchgoers at Emmanuel Church in downtown Charleston. And that, of course, sparked and built on a movement that was already underway in terms of challenging monuments. So the Rhodes Must Fall controversy was already going on. And then, we have this sort of wave in 2015, another wave in 2017 after the killing of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville. And now you're right. Now we're looking at that today. And for us, particularly in Charleston, and both of us are in Charleston now, the monument to John C. Calhoun, which had long been on Marion Square within eyeshot of or eyesight of the Mother Emanuel Church, which most of us thought would never come down, was actually removed from its pedestal. And that was a monument that had long been contested. It had long been opposed by members of the African-American community. Oral history suggests that it was raised up onto a 100-some foot plinth because so many members of the African-American community had done everything they could to deface the monument when it was lower down. So there was a long history of contest around that monument itself. And this was very much part of what we were thinking about throughout this process, mm-hmm. is that meaning for today of memorial space and ways that it's been both interpreted, misinterpreted, the way the contested memories of 19th century history in the present day. Kathy, do you want to?
You know, I think Kelly Bushnell in her essay in the book on Moby Dick starts with this really interesting anecdote about a whale that was killed, died in 2007, and they found embedded in his back a harpoon that would have been used in the 1880s. So this poor whale carried around this harpoon for, you know, decades and decades. And it just struck me as I was sort of prepping for this talk about that as sort of a metaphor for the way the 19th century past is so much a part of the 21st yeah. century. You know, that harpoon is still here and it might be covered up with the blubber, but it we're still carrying it around in a lot of ways. Mira Waits in her essay also talked about the spectral relationship of the past with the present, which I think is another interesting way to think about the past, that the 19th century past is really hovering over mm-hmm. The conflicts that we're talking about today. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, really reckoning with what the 19th century meant has got to be a part of how in this country we think about race relations, how the areas of the former British Empire still have to think about those same issues.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Another example, which I can but mention, The Gone with the Wind, this film, which was very well done. But again, there is so much controversy around the film today. And I had a chance to look to watch that introduction with which that film appears today. I thought that it's quite a drastic turn, right? How we understand this cultural artifacts, or how we understand this cultural material, so to speak, from the perspective of the 21st century. And it gives some perspectives, not only on our present day, but on how these events were perceived at the beginning of the 20th century, how the 20th century understood the events of the 19th century, but also what kind of memory the 20th century wanted to promote. So do you have any comments on this perception of Gone with the Wind today?
there are many Americans who take it as an accurate portrayal of the South and of race relations. And so it is very much that has a long legacy in terms of, one thread of the kind of contested memory of the 19th century for us.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, there's other Americans who say, oh, it's just such a fun movie and it's such a romantic story. And why do we have to ruin that? And, so that makes it more difficult, too, because some people see these things as nice cultural artifacts that they want to maintain. And, if people see them as difficult, how big a deal is that?
Mm-hmm.
To a lot of people, it's a huge big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and another thing that it makes me think about is how sometimes we are reluctant to deal with these difficulties and controversies and complexities, and it's just easier to dismiss those, but sometimes it's worth probably looking into those complexities that give some depth and some different insights into the history and into how we remember some historical events. So in the introduction part, you outline a theoretical background for the volume. What's the core of the volume's theoretical framework?
I think it is what Kathy had mentioned, that that so much of this is about the ways that individuals
mm-hmm.
Remember the past, both their own past. So the first part of the book really deals with sort of more private and individual memory making, and the second part deals with civic memories and that kind of interplay between individual memory and, say, sort of shorthand collective memory, but memories that are formed by a group and that are sort of embraced by a group.
Kathy, would you like to comment on that?
And added to that, I guess, is thinking about the way that, or I guess sort of what Amanda said, but to take this a little further, the way that individual memories are formed in interaction with broader societies
mm-hmm.
and cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So looking at the sites of memory, like monuments or tourist pilgrimages, which are teaching people to look at the past in a particular way, and the extent to which that meaning is fluid. Do different people respond to it differently? In different time periods, do we respond to it differently? How do these sites of memories change? How do individuals
mm-hmm.
make choices about responding to
mm-hmm. them? Oh, thank you, Kathy. Actually, my next question is connected with your current comment. So your volume specifies the interplay of the private and the public. Would you elaborate on this component in terms of commemorative practices in the 19th century? And the reason I ask this question is I believe our understanding of the public today is a little bit different from the 19th century or even the 18th century. I remember reading this book by Habermas, who was describing the formation of the public through coffee houses and through the salons. But for him, the public was some place where the individuals could somehow deliver themselves, right? Where they could share their ideas. So it was some, I don't want to say ideal place, but it was some place where you could share your opinions or you could share your ideas. Today, there is, I would say, the overwhelming presence of the public because we all connected to some social media. And as the moment, the second some stuff goes on the social media, it's not private anymore. So it transforms, it changes. So how was this public sphere or this interplay of the private and the public presented in the 19th century? Maybe some specific examples, like you mentioned the monuments, but how the individual, right, was somehow inserted in this public narrative, a public discourse.
One of the interesting things for me, and because there's such a variety of essays, it's a little hard to generalize, but one of the interesting things for me was the response of the former prisoners of war to this now sort of public, but public by admission fee space of a museum. and to the story, the narrative that that museum told. And their very personal responses. So mm-hmm. it was a space that became commodified and was also used to market the cigars and the candies made by the person who sponsored the museum. And to there was a restaurant there and a hotel associated with it. And so it became this kind of marketing gimmick as well as a hotel or as a prison and sort of a cabinet of curiosities as well, of sort of the weird and wonderful to try and attract people into this site. And, but for the prisoners, that was often deeply troubling because this was a site of suffering for them and a very individual suffering. And their experience of the space, Angela Riotto, the author of this essay, describes how some of them would use coming into this space and they would run and find the place on the floor where they had lain when they were in the prison. And so it is this very intensely personal experience of a public space for them. And at the same time, there's a whole genre of literature of prisoners, former prisoners telling their stories and explaining, kind of inserting themselves into a narrative of patriotism and of sacrifice for the nation that their experience sort of put them outside of. They had been captured. And of course, in some ways, this has resonance with current discussions about the nature, what it means to be capture and be a prisoner of war, but asserting manliness and asserting sacrifice, even though they had been imprisoned. And so you've got that kind of intense kind of civic interplay of the two. On a much more kind of personal level, we have an essay in there that deals with autograph albums. This is Jen Black's look at that. And that it's, this is very much within a community of friends and it's personal inscriptions, but they're intended to be read by the community to help create community and preserve a community and a kind of a moment in time of somebody's life. And as you're writing these inscriptions, you're very conscious of how you're going to be portrayed and that your character is coming out in these inscriptions. And so there's a very self, it's much like social media today, there's a very self-conscious self-portrayal for a semi-public sphere within that. So you've got, again, both in the kind of overtly private and the more public civic spaces, you've got that.
Mm-hmm. Kathy?
I think Amanda summed that up.
Thank you. And I really enjoyed reading that essay about the photos of those who passed away. And it wasn't only just interesting, it was creepy to some extent. But it also...
You see the photographs?
It also gave some insight into how the 19th century... residents, people were perceiving not only themselves, but how they saw their family, for example, stories in terms of a bigger picture, in terms of their country as well, and how it was difficult to let go, right, of those who passed away and how they tried to bring them back in this or that, or in one or the other form. But still, yeah, well, I won't lie to you. It was creepy a little bit.
And we talked about this when we were talking about that essay and the fact that particularly with the photographs of children, and again, this is something that's a little strange for us in the present day, is we have so many photographs of ourselves. But when a family member died, do you have something do you have a photograph of them when they were alive to remember them by? And, and so partly this new medium and this new technology creates a way of memorializing this person and this member of the family. And it is creepy for us today, but we were talking about, even when you have a child who is either stillborn or dies immediately after death, that we still have some of these practices of trying to remember.
And there was an article in the New York Times, I think while we were still working on the book, about some cultures in the United States where people do these postmortem photographs, like posing their family members. There was a picture of a man who I think had been a boxer and he was in his boxing clothes after he was dead. And some of that same process of sort of transgressing across death and remembering that person in the way they felt most powerful and most mm-hmm. most alive.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, the idea in the 19th century of the spirit photography in particular, this hope that this new technological medium could capture a soul, could capture an image of a soul. And, you know, it wasn't just, you know, sort of wishful thinking, but it was this kind of hope in a new technology that was also very much kind of the 19th century that was sort of fascinating. So there's both the kind of morbid aspect of it and also this just kind of moment of experimentation that was fascinating about that essay.
Mm-hmm. You, Amanda, and Kathy already mentioned, in spite of the fact that we are in the 21st century, we still feel, right, not only see, but also feel the 19th century. How would you describe the main difference between the commemoration consumption in the 19th century and the 21st century, if there are any differences in your opinion? What defined these main differences?
I think actually this is something we were talking about. There's actually a lot of crossover. Kathy, do you want to, this was something that you were talking about.
Do you think that a lot of our forms of memory today still mm-hmm. draw on the 19th century photography, you know, the social media that seems very similar to the albums that Amanda was talking about, monuments and tourism, travel, all those things that we do to remember the past, museums are growing out of 19th century forms.
Mm-hmm.
I do wonder, as you asked that, if there might be today more fluidity maybe in what things mean or mm-hmm. I don't know, the public meaning, the public mm-hmm. space mm-hmm. around them. You know, I think that perhaps in the 19th century, if say you build a monument to, I don't know, Cecil Rhodes, there's an overt meaning and other meanings are a little bit more silent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think, especially now in the 21st century, I think we're much more likely to have a lot of meanings out there in the public very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A lot of different interpretations, maybe.
Amanda?
Yes, I agree with that. And that's an interesting point. Things are moving so much faster, mm-hmm. and there is a real sense of instability in meaning. And then contest with that, you know, mm-hmm. people who feel threatened by that and efforts to shape the meaning kind of at the time on the ground. But what we were struck by that many of the forms that we use really are, they're updated, but they're very similar. So again, in the aftermath of the Emanuel massacre, Charleston saw a series of marches and protests, and it was this appropriating space. It was this asserting control over public space. It was photographing it. It was recording it in the newspapers. It was then posting it on social media. I was there. And so again, it sort of becomes part of that conversation, that self-portrayal of what I, whoever I am, did at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
There's an image that a local artist designed of a palmetto tree, which is the symbol of South Carolina, with these nine doves flying away from it, you know, sort of turning into these doves. And that gets turned into a number of kind of commemorative items. So you see it on t-shirts and you see it on beer koozies and you see it on, you know, mugs and everything else. And, you know, and people buy that to assert a connection to that moment and to what that means about the community. And, you know, it sort of struck us that the 19th century is where you really begin to see the creation of souvenirs,
mm-hmm.
of sort of mass-produced souvenirs, and the use of those by individuals to remember having participated in something and to, you know, again, to have this kind of connection to it. And so it's sort of the forms have been updated, but a lot of them really do have their roots in the 19th century.
Yeah, I think there is some irony and paradox in this statement that Amanda, you and Kathy made about fluidity. It seems like we have more devices to remember, but at the same time, we seem to remember less. And there is this silence that was mentioned as well. And I was thinking about the notion, which was mentioned in the preface, I believe, by Guy Biner, about social forgetting. Would you comment a little bit on this notion of social forgetting, which I believe is very important in terms of commemorative practices as well?
Yeah, the ways in which we forget the past is as powerful as the ways in which we remember them, right? So we can forget how terrible slavery was, but remember how beautiful a plantation is, yeah. Right? Plantations have become very contested spaces around Charleston lately. Physically beautiful buildings and beautiful landscapes and lovely places to walk around and weddings there because it makes great photographs. And then people start saying, but you're forgetting that these are essentially labor camps. And why do you want to get married at a labor camp? And so, yes, I think forgetting is very, very powerful. And I think you're right that one of the things that's happening now is the effort to not forget.
Mm-hmm.
To be more intentional about what we are remembering and how we are remembering, which does change the meaning of a space.
And it comes up in some of the essays, and particularly I'm thinking about the one that deals with South Africa and the commemoration of one of the South African times rebels against colonial rule. And then, of course, at first, he's depicted as a rebel, and the two loyal natives who helped to put down this rebellion are the ones who are commemorated. And there's this sort of forgetting then of under first colonialism and then under apartheid of Black South Africans. And then, of course, what we see in the late 20th and 21st centuries is the reinscription of those people into the space.
Mm-hmm.
And the question of remembering too, I mean, in his case, there was a township that whose occupants named very deliberately insisted on naming the township for him. So this kind of counter remembering in the face of a very deliberate top-down effort to forget,
mm-hmm.
And to make forgetting sort of a cornerstone of the national narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So it is that kind of contestation about what do we remember, what
mm-hmm.
do we forget?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I think we can also add some international perspective there as well. Again, speaking about Gone with the Wind and plantations, which were just mentioned, and as someone who comes from Eastern Europe and from post-Soviet country, that's the film that we saw about the Old South, and that's how we would think about the Old South based on this film. Of course, there were other things, there were other books, but the film itself was so popular. Yes, we would pay attention to these beautiful costumes, to the beautiful environment, to the beautiful plantation, but other things, since they were silenced, they were not, so to speak, activated for us, those who were exposed to the film. I also would like to ask you about the process of trivialization and banalization of commemorative practices and how they internalized in cultural memory.
I guess you can see that often in tourism.
Mm-hmm.
Tourism can tend to really sort of trivialize the past. Things have to be shortened to fit a guidebook. A trip to a place might be very brief, so you have to tell things quickly. We have a couple of essays on tourism, the one on India and the so-called sort of mutiny pilgrimages, which Amanda already referred to, where British tourists would travel around the sites where the 1857 Indian uprising happened and learn only what happened in 1857 and not the bigger history surrounding it. And of course, not the brutality with which the British put down this uprising. So a very selective view of history there. Johann Reusch also wrote an essay on tourism in the German Confederation, mm-hmm. right after the end of the Napoleonic Wars and the attempts of tourists to use sort of pedestrian travel as a way to sort of create a notion of what Germany is. But that too is a very selective vision, which could be seen to sort of reduce national identity to a notion of hiking and ruggedness and sort of manly fitness.
Mm-hmm. And it can be, it was sort of boiled down outside of Berlin, the Kreuzberg mountain, this 217-foot mountain that middle-class Berliners would go out and summit this thing, and kind of it was sort of landscaped to be, you know, sort of the prototypical German wilderness. And, you know, it's a Saturday afternoon sort of pilgrimage that you go on with your family, and you maybe have, you know, and yet it is something that he argues is part of a middle-class sort of assertion of identity and connection with the state and with this German history that increasingly is being used to define what a unified Germany is. So yes, I mean, there are the sort of ways that these experiences or these items are sort of boiled down for mass consumption. And yet at the same time, you know, that then allows the masses to participate in the construction of these shared identities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have this opportunity to share this research with your students? And if you do, what's their response?
Kathy?
Sometimes it depends on the books that we're using. I actually was just chatting with a student before this, and he asked me what work I was working on. And I said, well, we just published this book and we were going to be on your podcast. Mm-hmm. So there's a little publicity. It can get touchy because mm-hmm. students too have favored sort of myths of the past that they sometimes don't want challenged. I felt sometimes as undergraduate studying history that, you know, my favorite stories of the past were getting destroyed. And our students sometimes feel like that. And so talking about the difference between memory and history is an important thing to do with students. I think it can be done sometimes more easily when I'm talking about European history or British history that they don't feel a personal investment with than Amanda can do, for instance, in talking about the American South, which he obviously does, but touches our students in a much more immediate way. And because of everything we've already said about the power of past and personal identity, it gets difficult when someone is challenging that, as important as that work is to do.
Mm-hmm. Amanda.
Yes. I can see, though, using, and I actually have thought about using for this semester, the essay on Randolph Cemetery. And again, sort of as a talking about the construction of monuments that in some ways, the discussion about a monument to an assassinated black senator in South Carolina in the immediate aftermath of the American Civil War. In some ways, it takes the conversation a little bit away from the question of, does X monument come down now? What do we do about X monument here? And instead, it becomes a way to talk about, what does a monument mean? What does the dedication ceremony mean? What do processions mean for civic life and for civic belonging? So that's one way that I might use it. The essay on the German pedestrian tourism is also sort of a way of, in many ways, I mean, this is particular to Germany, but it is also something that we are seeing in the 19th century in the United States as artists and others are seeking in the natural world something that is inherently American and something around which to construct an American identity, and using things like the revolutionary past and the wars with Native Americans to define a white America, really, as an America, but to define what they saw as an America at the time. So Last of the Mohicans, or the Hudson River School of Painting, and to kind of talk about, to use the German domestic tourism to talk about ideas about nature and about history in a slightly different context, and to, I guess, to contextualize what's going on in the United States as part of a sort of international intellectual and nationalistic mm-hmm. sort of trend. Mm-hmm. I could see both of those.
Something that was mentioned by Kathy, the difference between history and memory. So how would you describe the main difference between history and memory? How do we differentiate between those two?
That is always a tough one. I think in many ways, history is the way we study the past, the questions we ask of the past, the way we research the past. Memory can often be sort of our inherent, a kind of inherited understanding, received understanding would be a better way. Often an uncritical understanding of the past. Mm-hmm. And history, I hope, is much more questioning, it's much more exploratory, it's much more investigating than simply receiving.
Amanda?
I think that uncritical is mm-hmm. the key there. And that memory is, too, something deeply personal. Mm-hmm. In whatever it means, it is deeply personal. And so a challenge to memory is a challenge to your own identity, which makes it a very sort of touchy ground.
Mm-hmm. Is your current research in any way connected with any of the aspects that was covered in this volume?
Not for me so much. Mm-hmm. My current research looks at early credit reporting. So the crossover is that some of the early credit reports are one of the few sources we have for looking at kind of middle class businesses. So it is that world of sort of 19th century middle class formation. And in a sense, these are little biographies of merchants in a business context. But that's about, it's more in teaching and in grappling with Charleston's mm-hmm. history and memory. In the classroom, that's where I'm sort of employing the ideas that we're thinking about here in this volume much more directly.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Kathy?
A little bit. It's more tied, I think, to my earlier project on tourism mm-hmm. in 19th century Scotland, which was very much an exploration of identity and how that's expressed and disseminated through tourism. But I am still more broadly working on the issue of 19th century Scottish identity. But how it's expressed in religious practices. Mm-hmm. And some of that does have to do with memory. There's this very, among some people, it's very strict observance of the Sabbath in the 19th century, like Sunday is the day everything shuts down. And a lot of that is based on the notion that Scotland is a covenanted nation, that as a nation they've made a pact with God, and that has to be maintained, and the Sabbath is the symbol of that. So the Sabbath does become part of memory, the memory of the covenant with God. And the question is, in an industrial age, can you really keep that going? Maybe you actually need the trains. Maybe you need shops to be open. Maybe workers need a day that they can go to the countryside and explore nature. And industry makes that possible. So how do you reconcile that memory of a kind of idealized past with the needs of an industrial society?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. That ties it more closely to Maura's work on the votive processions and the kind of memory of, and the sort of connection of religion to community through these objects, and to the way that 19th century bourgeois observers are looking back at this kind of idealized culture of a fishing community.
Yeah. And you know, that connection actually of covenant and memory really just came to me right now. So actually a good insight for me to remember.
Well, thank you so much, Amanda and Kathy. I wish you good luck on your research. And again, congratulations on the publication of this volume, which is fascinating. Fascinating because it really shows us how much of the 19th century we still have in the 21st century and what we can do with that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was an interesting and enjoyable discussion.
Today I spoke with Catherine Granier and Amanda Mutual, editors of Cultures of Memory in the 19th Century, Consuming Commemoration, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2020. Thank you so much for listening to the New Books in Literary Studies podcast.